Welcome to Inside Track. Santa Aurelia LLC is solely responsible for its content and pays for it. The views and opinions expressed on Inside Track are those of the host and guests and not necessarily endorsed by KVOI or its advertisers, but they should be. And now here's Bruce Ash.
Hello, insiders, and a very pleasant good afternoon to you, wherever you may be. Bruce Ash is on special assignment, executing a halo jump into a secure location. This is your host, Eb Wilkinson, welcoming you to a New Year's edition of Inside Track and day 307 of the 15-day Flatten the Curve. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. It's good to have you with us. This portion of the show has been brought to you by Essential Pest Control. Essential Pest Control, professional service you can depend on from a company you can trust. All critters fear the blue. We've got another quality program for you today. Starting today is Dr. Jay Bhattacharya. Dr. Bhattacharya is a professor of medicine at Stanford University, where he received both an MD and a PhD in economics. He's also a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research, a senior fellow at Stanford Institute for Economic Policy Research, a co-author of the Great Barrington Declaration. His research has been published in economics, statistics, legal, medical, public health, and health policy journals. Welcome, Dr. Bhattacharya. I hope I pronounced that correctly.
Oh, you did very well. Thanks.
Great. Hey, you had a great article based on a panel presentation at the October Hillsdale College Free Market Forum.
Yeah, so that presentation I was talking about, I mainly was interested in understanding what the right way to deal with the COVID epidemic is. And I think we've made a lot of mistakes, and I propose a very, very different strategy.
Well, how deadly is COVID-19, first of all?
Well, if you look at it's confusing because if you just look at the number of deaths and the number of cases, you get a picture that's very, very incomplete. In order to understand how deadly it is, you need to know how many people actually have been infected. It turns out to be many times more than the number of cases. The way we know that is from studies of antibodies in the population. There are a lot more people who have antibodies to COVID-19 infection than you'd realize just from cases. Now, there's been 100-some studies done around the world, and it turns out that the death rate from COVID, the infection fatality rate from COVID, depends very sharply on your age. If you're under 70, the survival rate from COVID infection is 99.95%.
Wow.
99. Yeah, I mean, it's really, really high. If you're over 70, it's low. It's lower. It's 95%. So that means it's a pretty deadly disease if you're older. 95% survival sounds really high, but still it's 5% more infection fatality. Whereas under 70, 99.95% survival.
And how about for the kids?
Oh, it's practically 100%. There was more kids that have died of the flu this year than of COVID-19 infection. And in fact, that's been true. Even if you look at flu from the previous years, it's been flu. Death rates for kids are much higher than COVID. Fortunately, COVID does not seem to harm kids very much.
Well, so in early March, the reported fatality rate was roughly 3%. It's now less than 0.5% based on what you just said. Can we trust those stats, and how do you juxtapose those for us?
Yeah, so in March, what people were doing is that they were ignoring the fact that I just said earlier, which is that there were many, many, many times more infections than cases. In March, we were identifying cases based on symptoms and also based on the testing resources we had. And frankly, we didn't have very much. And so what looked like we thought we had all the number of cases in the denominator, and that of those, we were identifying really severe cases, right? So people who were really, really severely ill, we were using our testing resources on people we thought were very sick, and 3% of those folks died. And so people thought that that's typical of what a COVID infection looks like. But in fact, what we know now is that there's a very wide range of clinical presentations. The vast majority of people either have no symptoms at all or very mild symptoms. It's a tiny fraction of the cases that end up with the severe viral pneumonia that you see in the hospital. That's why we get the death rate numbers I showed you. And again, this is based on 100 studies that have been published around the world. And now a summary of those studies was published in the Bulletin of the World Health Organization. That's which is where I'm getting my numbers from.
So if I have no symptoms, why would I think about getting tested anyway?
You wouldn't generally, right? You wouldn't even know to get to
right.
The only reason. Yeah.
So
the only way people know is that if with no symptoms is because they're forced to get tested for other reasons, because their employer or their school forces them to get tested.
Okay, so with those numbers, who's really at risk from COVID?
It's really older people. Age is the single most important risk factor. So just to give you some sense, if you're 80 years old, the mortality rate from COVID is probably on the order of 4 or 5%, right?
Okay.
So 97% survival still, 3, 4, 5% is pretty high.
Okay, and then the younger you are, the less risk you're at. You talked about focused protection and how it's used in the article. Could you tell us about that?
Sure. So what we think about what the right thing to do is in the context of this, we have to understand that who's really at highest risk. So we just said the oldest people. Doesn't it make sense to focus our resources on protecting the people who are at highest risk? I mean, that's the basic idea of focused protection, is to devote resources to considerable resources, overwhelming resources to protecting the most vulnerable. And in fact, so for instance, 40% of people who have died in the United States thus far from COVID lived in nursing homes. We should have been doing a much better job in the early days of the epidemic in protecting nursing home residents. I think we've done better since, but we still have not done as well as we could have. Testing, for instance, many staff in nursing homes work in multiple nursing homes. So you get a positive staff member potentially passing the disease from one nursing home to another. There should have been controls on that almost immediately. Testing resources to make sure that visitors to nursing homes aren't positive. Just a lot more attention to COVID wards inside nursing homes, so people who are positive won't mingle with people who aren't positive. Things like that. Just training, a whole bunch of resources devoted to making sure the nursing homes folks living in nursing homes are safe. Now with a vaccine, we actually have a perfect opportunity for that. Let's vaccinate every single person living in a nursing home immediately. I mean, they should be first priority because we know that's where the death is.
And what about the workers in the nursing home?
Same thing, right? Anyone caring for an older person should be vaccinated, absolutely, immediately, because we don't want a staff worker passing the disease on to someone who actually is vulnerable.
Okay, so we lock down the nursing homes, those people at risk, and we just go forward from there.
Let me complete the thought, because for the younger population, people who are under 70, remember the mortality rate is very low. It's like, and the survival rate is 99.95. On the other hand, what we've done in response, the lockdowns have been devastating. Children have lost a year or more of school. Almost a year, because they're going to lose a year of school. Many of them, especially the poorest kids, are going to be hardest hit. Young adults, 1 in 4, seriously considered suicide this past June. This is the lockdown, not COVID itself. People skipped cancer treatments. People skipped cancer screening. Many women are going to show up with phase 4 breast cancer that should have been caught earlier in earlier stages this year. And they'll show up next year, or this, I guess, 2021, this year, with it. I think it was an enormous mistake that will harm the health of every single younger person on net, and they don't face a huge risk from COVID relative to the threat from the lockdowns.
And that
what's the answer?
That doesn't even count people for heart attacks, strokes, things like that.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to be counting the cost for this forever. I mean, for a very long time. And that's just in the United States. I mean, the UN in April reported that 130 million additional people are at risk of starvation as a consequence of the economic damage from the lockdowns worldwide.
Wow.
If you're living on $2 a day, and you have the GDP of the world takes a hit, you're going to be at risk for starvation. That's exactly what's happened.
Wow. So you're in California. How's that lockdown going?
I mean, it really hasn't done much, has it? I mean, we've experienced an enormous surge in COVID cases and COVID deaths. Lockdowns give us an illusion of control over the disease. We think we can use the lockdown to manage the path of disease. At best, what they do is they delay cases to the future. And eventually, the cases happen because of the virus. It's very difficult to control the spread, as we've seen.
Hey, Jay, we've got a caller calling in right now, Charles. Charles, go ahead.
Dr. Bhattacharya, am I saying it right?
Yes. Let's talk with you,
okay.
Charles.
Okay. Thank you. You too. This is fascinating. Two questions come up. You say that we're delaying the result. I know that you're. I heard Eb talk about your bio. You're both a medical doctor and a statistician. Is that correct?
Economist, yeah.
An economist. And so I wonder, has anyone looked at the comparison of A, what the delay is, and B, what the projected what the effect of that delay will be?
Yeah, there's been a lot of scientific work trying to understand what lockdowns actually do. And I think the very best work compares similar countries or similar states that implement lockdowns at different times, and then takes into account how the lockdowns might, even from a theoretical perspective, affect disease dynamics. And the outcome is simple. Like, basically, the models, they predict that the lockdowns move cases to the future, right? This is the logic behind the 2 weeks to flatten the curve, right? We don't want, but the hospitals might be overrun in the next 2 weeks. Let's lock down. The cases will still happen, but after the 2 weeks. What happened in many places, and California is a prime example, is that we've tried to, like, continuously lock down. That can't last forever. And what the literature says, and this is what has happened, is that eventually those cases will come back out. This seems to be a disease that has a very, very seasonal characteristic as well. So when there's dry, cool weather, that's when the disease spreads. And so it's, in some sense, not surprising that the California surge has happened during our late fall winter.
And has anyone done a definitive cost-benefit analysis between the disease and the response to the disease? In other words, has anybody looked at the solutions, the cost of the solutions versus the height of the problem? And I'll take my answer to that off the radio. Thank you. You really give a really good detailed answer. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much. So I think no one has done a definitive study as yet, because in some sense we're still counting the lockdown harms. They're not harms that happen immediately, although they're enormous ones that have happened immediately. Just to give you some sense of the immediate harms, there was a study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association estimating the consequences on children, the health of children. If children skip a year of school, you think that's just a year, you can make it up. But in fact, people don't make it up. That has long-term consequences on the kids who end up missing a year of school are poorer and live less healthy lives over the long run. The study estimated that our kids lost 5.5 million life years as a consequence of the shutdown. That's just one cost. That's just our children. We're going to be counting these costs for a long time. There's no definitive study as yet because all the harms haven't yet happened. The only question in my mind at this point is how many orders of magnitude more the lockdown harms are than the lives we've supposedly saved from COVID as a consequence of the lockdowns.
Yeah, and every month that goes by, every week that goes by, it gets worse. Hey, Jay, we have to take a quick break. Hang with us. We'll be right back, okay?
Delighted.
Great, thank you.
Customers come first at Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus.
What other kind of customers do you have?
So our biggest customers are actually like ranchers and people from outside of the Tucson area. They're buying a lot of square tubing. They're buying a lot of stuff for their ranch to close off fences.
We'll sell anything from 10 feet to 10,000 feet to somebody that comes in because we have new steel and surplus steel from steel mills. The reason we're able to get such good pricing on some of this stuff is, A, we sell scrap to the mill. So we have a relationship there, and then we can buy material, what they're making, bringing it back. And so we save on freight, and we have relationships for years with them. So I think that's really our niche market. We'll sell whatever you need.
Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. Call 209-1579. Stop by the yard, 701 East 36th Street. Open Monday through Saturday.
It's termite season.
Hi, it's me.
And bugs fear the blue trucks from Essential Pest Control.
Go blue at Essential Pest Control. We'll eliminate those bugs, bees, and termites. And stop paying too much to that national provider. Buy local for great service and affordable rates. Call Essential Pest Control because termites fear the blue.
Call for the blue trucks from Essential Pest Control. 886-3029. That's 886-3029. Or check online at essentialpest.com.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Wouldn't it be great if political leaders could create that country again? Learn how to do exactly that, one family at a time, with Imus Wilkinson Investment Management. Call me, Eb Wilkinson. IMUSWilkinson.com. 777-1911. 777-1911.
Welcome back. We're here with Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, MD, PhD in economics from Stanford, talking about COVID-19. So, Doctor, we were talking about the lockdowns and how effective they have been. You're out there in California. What's going on again with lockdowns out there?
Well, our schools are still closed for in-person instruction. Many businesses are shut down. There's been some legal action over trying to keep the restaurants open or closed, but most restaurants have suffered. Gyms are closed. We have a stay-in-place order, I guess, indefinitely in Los Angeles County. And yet the cases have been very, very high all through December. The lockdowns really haven't done very much as far as reducing the caseload, I don't think, but people have suffered enormously, I think, from these restrictions that have been put in place basically since March.
Wow. So how is this virus transmitting in California when they're doing all these lockdowns? And, you know, shouldn't we just open it up and say, screw it and move on?
Yeah, I mean, I think on the first question, that the virus transmits, mostly in home settings. Lockdowns mean what? You think about a lockdown and you think to yourself, oh, well, that just means everyone's quarantined and separated from one another. But in fact, that's not in practice how lockdowns work. People have to go get groceries. People have to, have normal, just some social interactions. We're not meant to be isolated, and the virus spreads during those times. I mean, the theory of the lockdown and the actual practice are very, very different. So I think that's the first thing. The second thing, I think the key thing to me about opening up is, can we protect the vulnerable when we do so? So I don't think I'm not yet in favor of fully opening up without some sort of, I'm in favor of lifting the lockdowns that mostly do nothing, but I am in favor of protecting the vulnerable, simultaneously or even before. And I think with the vaccine, we have a perfect opportunity to do that. We should be in California, and we're not, unfortunately, prioritizing the oldest populations, the oldest people who are vulnerable, people with middle-aged people with chronic conditions, essential workers who are older and yet forced to sort of work anyways. Those folks should be prioritized for vaccinations, and at this point, we're not doing that.
We have another caller. Philip wants to ask a question. Philip, go ahead.
Yes, I might have lost a little bit while I was trying to get on the air, but I'd like to ask you, what do you think about this attitude that the media has on shutting down any comments or questioning of the validity and virility of this virus? It seems that you cannot have an opinion contrary to what the official thing is. People are losing their jobs. Can you comment on that, please? Thank you.
Sure. I think that the suppression of free speech around this virus has been one of the worst outcomes I've seen. Well, I mean, there's so many bad outcomes. Maybe we shouldn't rank them. But it has been very, very unfortunate. Even verified facts, like the ones I told at the beginning about the mortality rate of the virus, which is, again, the survival rate is 99.95% below 70 and 95% above 70. That's a fact. It was published by the World Health Organization, summarizing 100 studies, and yet the media has done the best it can to cause panic around the virus. And I think that has had enormously negative consequences. And suppressing dissent around the right policy of the virus, that also has been very, very unfortunate. I didn't ever think something like that could happen in the United States, which I'd always believed to value free speech. I'm hoping that in the coming months that we can have a real discussion about the role the media and big tech has played in suppressing free and open discussion about the facts about this virus and the policy around it.
Why do you think the media is doing that?
I don't know the reasoning. I mean, I think partly, of course, the virus has been in the very biggest story, and I think there's partly that. There are people in the scientific community that have pushed panic, and so the media is reflecting on that. But there's also been a debate, a healthy debate in the scientific community, and I think it's the responsibility of the media to reflect that debate, not simply just to promote the views of the most panicked.
So masks, do they work? Do they not work?
I think in some settings they were. I mean, obviously in hospital settings they're very, very, very important. If you're sitting in a setting where there's you can't socially distance at all, and there's a lot of people around, masks are important. Let me answer a slightly different question, which is: do mask mandates work? Right? Do the mandating of masks actually produce reduction in cases? I think the answer to that is no. There's a lot of evidence that mask mandates, you can compare states that are similar to one another, and you end up, one introduces a mask mandate and one doesn't, and it doesn't seem to have an enormous effect on the number of cases in the long run. It's similar to like what the lockdowns do. They maybe delay cases. I think part of the reasoning is that people, when they use masks, the theory of it is you always are wearing it with this N95 mask that where the viral particles are cut off. But in practice, they're uncomfortable to wear. Many people, when they wear them, don't wear them really properly. Outside, they seem to have almost no effect whatsoever. So I guess the answer is it depends. But the mandates themselves, I think the main cost of them is they undercut people's trust in public health, right? So if they really are so important, why not just show folks the evidence around them and then give them good advice about when it's most effective and what sorts of masks are most effective? Instead, we've had this like messaging that's gone back and forth from, oh no, masks are useless in March, to they're absolutely vital to slow the spread, where the actual data are somewhere in between and complicated and nuanced. Why not just, instead of mandating, provide people with the actual information?
We have one more caller, Bill. Bill, go ahead.
I'm just curious, when in our history, either in this country or around the world, have we responded to a virus in the way we've done in this case? It seems like everything, human history, science, medical experience has taught us has been turned on its head. And I'm just curious, can you point to a situation where we've dealt with a virus that, quote-unquote, supposedly has this much mortality rate in this the manner that we've gone about doing it?
We violated every single norm in public health that I was aware of. I think this is absolutely extraordinary in my experience. I think you have to go back at least 100 years to the 1918 flu epidemic, and even then there was a few cities that had some limited lockdowns, and it lasted, it's 3 to 6 weeks. I don't know of any instance in modern human history where public health has responded this way to a viral outbreak like this. And in fact, there's lots of contrary things. We didn't shut down during the 2009 H1N1 epidemic. We didn't shut down during the late 20th century epidemics in the 50s and 60s from the flu or the 70s. We've had a series of these respiratory outbreaks with similar characteristics to COVID-19. I mean, COVID-19 in some ways is a little worse, especially for the older. But in any case, we've never responded in this way, at least in the past 100 years, and nothing of this scope that's lasted for so long.
Bill, follow up question?
I see doctors coming out and posting things occasionally online and whatnot, but there doesn't seem to be a serious discussion, at least that I can tell, in the medical community about this particular situation. I'm guessing that there are some doctors that are doing it, but is there any sense that there's a widespread, cynical approach, if you will, amongst the average medical doctor saying, why are we doing it this way?
I mean, I was the co-author of a declaration called the Great Barrington Declaration, where we've had, hundreds of thousands of normal folks sign on, 50,000 epidemiologists, doctors, public health people sign on. There is a significant level of discomfort with this policy in the scientific community and in the medical community. But the problem is that that view has been difficult to get out. A lot of people who have this discomfort have been sort of cowed into silence around this, simply because it's very easy to shut down the debate by saying, look, if you aren't in favor of lockdowns, you must be in favor of the virus. So I think that idea has silenced many, many people, and people who have spoken up have been slagged. I think that that's been very, very unfortunate. A free and open debate would have resulted in a much better policy outcome than we have had. But I do think that there's a significant fraction of the scientific community that is deeply uncomfortable with the policies we followed. And I suspect that those folks are going to start to speak up in coming months.
Bill, thank you. Jay, what about the treatment of COVID-19? We're hearing everything from hydroxychloroquine to Tubad.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've learned a lot in the last several months about how to treat and how not to treat the disease. So I think in the early days of the epidemic, we vastly overused ventilators. We were much too aggressive in using ventilators to manage late-stage disease. And I think, unfortunately, that's led to the unnecessary deaths of many, many, many people. But we also had some advances. So, for instance, the use of dexamethasone in late-stage disease to reduce the overaction of the immune system has been very good. That's produced some good results. There have been other advances in managing people with the late-stage viral pneumonia, I think, that have led to a very sharply decreased case fatality rate. For early stage disease, I think it's been actually kind of an unfortunate thing. I mean, there have been some advances. For instance, the use of these monoclonal antibody treatments or polyclonal antibody treatments that seem to be very effective. The evaluation of small molecules like hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin, which have there seems to be some evidence in favor of them from other countries and other settings, although more for ivermectin, I think, than hydroxychloroquine. In any case, we haven't done the evaluations I would have expected to be done by this. There's no reason not to be able to do a rapid randomized evaluation of these small molecules. It's just that no one has any financial interest in running these things, and the government has sort of clamped down on the funding of these sorts of studies. There have been studies like this done for ivermectin in other countries, typically poor countries that can't afford the more expensive kinds of treatments that we can afford. But I don't see why we haven't done them here, and we really ought to have.
I hate to do this. We've got to wrap this up. How do we find more of your content?
Oh, I've been writing a whole series of op-eds. I can't do Twitter. It's emotionally too difficult for me to stay on Twitter. So I'm writing and speaking as much as I possibly can. So if you look for my you might do is you might follow my colleague Dr. Martin Kulldorff, who is on Twitter, who's a co-author of the Great Barrington Declaration. Martin Kulldorff, Kulldorff, who's a professor of medicine at Harvard University. So he posts a lot of the stuff that we write together.
Dr. Bhattacharya, thank you so very much. We'd love to have you back. It's a fascinating topic, especially right now. We're going to go ahead and take our next break, and we'll be right back.
It's termite season.
Bugs fear the blue trucks from Essential Pest Control.
Go blue at Essential Pest Control. We'll eliminate those bugs, bees, and termites. And stop paying too much to that national provider. Buy local for great service and affordable rates. Call Essential Pest Control because termites fear the blue.
Run for your life!
Call for the blue trucks from Essential Pest Control. 886-3029. That's 886-3029. Or check online at essentialpest.com.
I'm proud to welcome my good friends at Tucson Iron and Metal Retail to Inside Track as an advertiser. Jamie Kipper and her staff are conservation experts. They sell round and square steel tubing, metal plate and roofing materials, as well as new and used steel, aluminum, and stainless steel to ranchers, artists, interior designers, roofers, and do-it-yourselfers, just like all of the listeners here. Tucson Iron and Metal Retail is open Monday through Fridays, 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., and Saturdays, 8 a.m. to noon. Tucson Iron and Steel Retail, 701 East 36th Street. Call 520-209-1576 or go to TucsonIronRetail.com. And when you do call, mention this ad and receive an additional 10% discount on their already great prices.
I'm Eb Wilkinson with Imus Wilkinson Investment Management. I don't ever want you to be dependent on government ever again. I want you to become financially independent. You will never, ever have to depend on socialist security for your survival. We are here to guide you to financial independence. That's imuswilkinson.com, 777-1911. That's 777-1911.
Welcome back to Inside Track. This portion of today's show brought to you by Jamie Kipper and her dad, Gary Kipper, from Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. Find out what conversation is about at Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus, their recycling specialists located at 701 East 36th Street, TucsonIronSurplus.com, or find them on Facebook. And do you have a home improvement project you want to get started this year? Worried about the cost and the luxury? Corazon Cabinets sells legacy J&K and Conestoga cabinets. Call Corazon Cabinets at 488-2266 and schedule a visit to their new showroom at 4700 South Park. Corazon Cabinets, luxury you can afford. Now, joining us the second half of the show is Sheriff Mark Napier. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here, Eb. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank God 2020 is behind us.
I couldn't agree more. It was a tough year on many different fronts.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, just to be clear, you do not have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be broadcast over Southern Arizona and archived on the internet. And since you didn't bring a microphone, one will be afforded for you.
Perfect. Mother said, don't ever say anything you'd be ashamed to have other people repeat.
Perfect. Hey, you came in as the 34th sheriff of Pima County on January 1st, 2017. Medal of Merit twice, Medal of Service, the Chief of Police Citation of Excellence, the Unit Medal, the Retirement Medal, and the Magnus Leadership Medal. You've managed the seventh largest sheriff's department in the nation. It's pretty good creds.
Yeah, I've had a blessed career. I really have. I got to give a shout out. I think my wife may be listening. We've been married for 37 years. I've been a police officer for 39 years last month, and I couldn't have done any of this without her and the support of family. I've had a blessed career. I've been decorated multiple times in line of duty, and I've had the ability to go from a relatively small police department in Iowa as a patrol officer and SWAT operator to being the sheriff of, like you say, one of the largest counties in the United States. It's been an amazing ride. That ride is over, being sheriff, but I'll start on Monday morning as the chief of the Cochise County Sheriff's Department, and I'll be running day-to-day operations in Cochise County, hopefully for about the next 4 years.
Okay, so with that new career that you've got going on, what is your job actually going to be?
Well, if you put it in a business construct, Eb, I'd be the COO, Chief Operating Officer. Sheriff Daniels contacted me. He and I have been good friends for quite a long time. And after the election did not appear it was going to go my direction, he said, hey, would you like to come down here as my number two? And I said, well, what do you have in mind? And he said, well, what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to run the department. I'll be the sheriff. So the department reports to you. You report to me. You take care of the day-to-day operations, and I'll go be sheriff and do sheriff things. And I said, that's perfect. That's what I do. And I think it'll be a really good experience, going kind of back to my roots of being a smaller agency, more rural, less suburban law enforcement, urban law enforcement. So it's kind of going back to my roots right here at the end of my career life.
Do you have any goals for this position, or you just run it and be the COO?
No, I don't think, Eb, if you're a leader, you never run something and just let it run. You're always trying to make something better. So I've got to get my feet under me there. But I don't think a true leader ever sits and says, okay, it's running, and I'm just kind of a placeholder. True leadership is about making things better than when you found them, and that when you leave them, things are better for the fact that you were there. That's what true leadership's about. So I'll look, and I'm sure there are things that we can improve on in Cochise County. Sheriff Daniels is a close friend and an excellent sheriff, so I know that things are going well down there. There are some issues and challenges with the detention facility. Mostly it's the facility itself that I think need to be addressed, and there's budget, and of course COVID and crime and border crime, all those things that we have in every other law enforcement agency.
You know, you talk about the true leadership. You came in as sheriff of Pima County where morale was low. You completely changed that. What did you do different?
This will sound trite, but first of all, I don't think you should be a leader if you don't care about people. And I genuinely, with every fiber of my being, care about the people who are doing the real work of the department. And that's not the CEO anymore. That's the people that were handling calls out in the county last night while I was asleep warm in my bed. Those are the people doing the real work of the department, and those are the people that you should serve. And I believe in servitude leadership, and I have an infectious enthusiasm for what I do. I've been doing it, like I said, for 39 years. I absolutely adore law enforcement. I adore putting on my uniform in the morning, take great pride in making sure that it's my shirt's ironed and my stuff squared away. And you caught me on my way to the range the other morning to make sure I could still put holes in targets. So I just love what I do, and I think that translates. People see that, and you can't fake it, Eb. You cannot fake it. Either it's in your heart or it's not, and cops are very perceptive. If it's not in your heart, they'll see that. And I love what I do. I've had a blessed life of being able to do it, and I think that helps other people kind of get more excited about their career as well.
And your deputies sure respect you.
Well, I'm pretty easy. I wear my heart on my sleeve, and I'm very consistent. I don't ever get rattled, which some people misinterpret, honestly, that, well, he's indifferent or he doesn't care. It's just, if you were shooting at me right now, I would be just exactly the same as I am right now. I'd just be doing different things. I just don't ever get rattled. I don't get angry. I don't get upset. I'm very predictable. And I never wanted, and I had bosses like that you wonder, is your boss on the meds today? Because you don't know which boss you're going to find when you come into work. I'm never that way. I'm always the same, and I treat people with the same kindness and respect that I'd like to be treated.
Well, you've had a lot of experience in law enforcement. Anything changed in the last 5 years?
Well, budget. Budget is a cyclical thing. You know, we've had some budget challenges with the recession, and I know you're in the financial realm, so you know that that was a significant challenge, and it impacts municipal and public sector budgets. So we've been very challenged with navigating those waters over the past 5 years. Of course, COVID. COVID's a real deal in law enforcement for many reasons, primarily for sheriffs because we operate the jail. And if you get the virus within the general population, it can run rampant. It's just the perfect environment for a virus to spread very rapidly. So the challenge of keeping COVID out of general population and keeping your workforce healthy, that's been a significant challenge. The border is an ongoing challenge. It's been a challenge for the more than 30 years I've been here in the Valley. That's not going to change anytime in the near future. So it's kind of odd, Eb. I mean, I look back at where I started in 1981 to today. Some of the challenges are the same. Some of them are very different. My youngest son's a Tucson police officer. He's been on 8 years. And I told him that, you know, at some point you're going to be the old head. And you'll be saying, you know, how things were back in the day, like he and I, when we have a beer on the back porch, I talk about how things were back in the day. And I can't imagine 30 years from now what law enforcement will be like, but some of the challenges will remain the same. But it has been a very challenging 39 years, I know that.
So you talk about COVID and keeping it out of the jails. Has that been effective?
We have been actually a leader in the country on that, and we really have. When I saw COVID coming, from everything that I could see, it was going to be a public health issue. So in about March of last year, I contacted a good friend, Dr. Richard Carmona, former U.S. Surgeon General, and I said, Doc, would you like to come back and be a senior advisor to me to help me with the public health aspect of confronting this virus? He said, sure. So one of the first assignments I gave Dr. Carmona, I said, go to my jail and tell me what I need to do from a public health perspective. I know what to do from a public safety perspective. I get that. That's what I do. But from public health perspective, I'm out of my element. So Doc went down there and he came back with a list of recommendations about how we screen people when they come in, how we segregate prisoners, how we realign the physical facilities within the jail to avoid casual transmission. And we've been very effective. We've had a couple of cases recently that have got in, but we've got them very quickly. We're able to segregate those prisoners, so we did not have a major outbreak like Arizona Department of Corrections has. Maricopa County's had some very significant challenges. The other thing that we don't talk about very much, Ed, but it's really near to my heart, is that many law enforcement officers have lost their life due to complications from COVID. And one happened to be a very dear friend of mine, Sheriff Benny Napoleon, who was the sheriff in Wayne County, Michigan. Actually, Detroit is where Wayne County is. And Benny was a good friend and a little bit older than I am, an African-American sheriff. And he lost his life last month due to complications from COVID. Actually, that is one of the leading causes of law enforcement deaths this past year.
Well, we have to take a quick break. Oh, wait. Good. The good news is Tom says we don't need to take a break. Let's move on from there.
Okay.
I grew up in the Detroit area, so I know that area well, and that name is very familiar. I'm sorry to hear about that. How many law enforcement officers are affected right now in Pima County with the coronavirus?
Well, in Pima County, I don't know, and it's a moving target because as people get infected, they get better. So it's kind of a moving target. We've probably had about, I'm estimating about 24 at the Pima County Sheriff's Department that have been infected. We've had no fatalities of our personnel, but we've had some people that have gotten very ill. One of my chiefs got very ill, and he's otherwise an exceptionally healthy young man, and he got exceptionally ill with it. So it is a serious illness. We should take it seriously, but we should also take a rational approach to it. There are other things that are the thing with 100% fatality rate is being born.
Yes.
Everybody who's born is eventually going to pass away. But we need to take this seriously because people that are, higher risk, other health issues can be very significantly affected by this virus.
We had Pima County come out and decide to put a curfew from 10 o'clock in the evening till 5 o'clock in the morning. Did you do anything, instruct your officers to do anything different?
Well, what we did is what we are going to continue to do is to take an education approach to that. With respect to businesses, the enforcement arm of that is Pima County Public Health, not us. And that would be enforced against their business license, not by us, meaning law enforcement. And quite honestly, law enforcement has a lot of things to do. And while we certainly embrace and care deeply about the public health crisis facing this nation under the pandemic, that is only a small part of the things that we're responsible for in a public safety realm. So we've been continuing under my guidance, which actually ended 2 days ago, take an educational approach to issues that we find. We found that was pretty darn effective.
We're not randomly pulling people over at 10:01 for being on the streets.
No. And that would not be something that we would do under my watch. Now it's Sheriff-elect Nanos is currently the sheriff, and that might be a question better directed to him as he's now the authority here in Pima County.
And under your watch, were you doing anything with mask enforcement or,
no,
once
just
again,
education,
pure education?
Yeah, just education. And I do believe there's some efficacy to wearing masks, and I encourage people to do that. We have one of my son-in-laws has diabetes, and that puts him at extreme risk for complications from COVID. And he just got the vaccine, which was good. And then we have a couple of very young grandchildren that, we want to make sure are protected. So I think it's just a common sense. It's like the flu or any other health thing. We need to be sensible, take sensible precautions. And, I don't go outside in the rain in a T-shirt on a cold day because I'll get a cold. So you just have to take sensible precautions.
Yeah. Hey, seen a lot in the news recently, again, in places like Portland, Oregon. Will public response to recent events change the doctrine of law enforcement?
It should not. You know, I embrace, as, and I know you do as a constitutional person, the rights of the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights. But the expression of speech does not include burning down buildings. Peaceful assembly is not throwing rocks and bottles at law enforcement officers. I think law enforcement still has an affirmative responsibility to do two things, which you can do. You can strike a balance. Is protect people's legitimate First Amendment rights, which we took an oath to do, an unwavering oath, an unqualified oath, but at the same time to take the other part of our oath, which is to protect public safety. They're not in opposition to one another. If people want to march and peacefully protest and have their First Amendment rights heard, I am duty-bound by the Constitution to ensure that they can do that in a peaceful and law-abiding way. By the same token, if they're burning down buildings and assaulting people and things like that, I have an affirmative responsibility to maintain public safety. So it's not a dichotomous argument. It's not one thing or the other.
So what we see in Portland, certainly we've not seen that here in Pima County at all. Probably not going to see that in Cochise County either.
No.
Yeah, so your response is that's not happening.
No. It should not even be an argument. There should not be the argument about whether or not we support people's right, which does not exist, to burn down buildings, to damage public property, to injure innocent persons. There is no right to do that. And conversely, law enforcement has an affirmative responsibility to respond to those things. And it's not because we don't want people to express their First Amendment rights. We do. We'll protect those. We've taken an oath to do so. But by the same token, we've taken an oath to support public safety. And I think you can do both those things in a responsible and mature and articulate way.
So how do you balance your role as sheriff with the guidelines the county gives you?
Well, that's,
because you don't work for the county. I mean, you do work for the county, but not for the county supervisor.
That is correct. You're well aware of where government derives its power. And as an arm, an elected official, the sheriff derives his power from the will of the people. And that's where the power and the authority is derived from. It's not from the Board of Supervisors or the county administrator. The sheriff alone acts to the will of the people. And that is a very serious obligation. That's why you're an elected official. That's why sheriffs are not appointed. They're elected. And that's a very important fabric in this country, which is under attack in many locations, Portland being one of those, Seattle being another, where they want to now appoint sheriffs because they don't want this autonomous law enforcement figure to say, I'll give you an example. The Board of Supervisors had a resolution prohibiting the use of rubber bullets. You know what I said? Noted.
Nice.
You're not going to tell me. I have almost four decades of experience doing this. You will not tell me how to do crowd control. You have no expertise in that. I do. And if non-lethal projectiles or less lethal projectiles are the way to most effectively manage a crowd with the least likelihood of injury to persons or property, that's what law enforcement should do. That's what we're trained to do. We don't just willy-nilly start firing this stuff at people, nor should we ever do that. But that is a tool in our toolbox that government, as an edict, and an uninformed edict, I might add, should not take away from law enforcement.
So recent scandals in the way the FBI was politicized to go after the Trump administration, how has that affected law enforcement's trust of the FBI?
I think at a line level, not at all. I have a great relationship with the FBI office here in Tucson and the state office. So I don't think at a local level at all. It's in Washington, D.C., it's more political. Here at the ground level, we get along well, we communicate well. I consider the SAC here at the Tucson office a close friend and the one in Phoenix as well. And we should have a close cooperative working relationship with people at the ground level. I don't think anything about that's changed.
There's not a lot said about the FBI operating here in Tucson, but I know that they do a lot down here.
They do. You know, all the bank robberies are federal. You know, a lot of the trafficking of humans, a whole bunch of things the FBI gets involved in. In a support role, I'm a member of the executive committee of the Arizona Joint Terrorism Task Force, which the FBI, you know, administers, provides oversight for. So we have a great relationship at the ground level.
Is there still a lot of human trafficking going on right now?
There is. We're not paying a lot of attention to the border because we're distracted with other things, but the number of people coming across the border is still at an all-time high. It's not as high as it was 8-9 months ago. So when you compare it to 8-9 months ago, it's down. You can compare it to 2-3 years ago, it's up. And there are some very significant challenges there. I've talked to Mark Morgan, who is Commissioner of Customs and Border Protection, conference call, also several people at Department of Homeland Security in D.C. One of the things we're most worried about, there's a, without going in too far into the weeds, there's a thing called Title 42 and MPP, Migrant Protection Protocol. The Biden administration, to its credit, has currently said it has no intention of removing either of those two things. I applaud that. That's very common sense. Title 42 allows for almost the immediate repatriation of people who come across the border without proper documentation. Migrant Protection Protocol allows us to hold people longer than the 20 days. If both of those go away at the same time, we're going to be right back to where we were a year ago with these huge numbers of people in detention facilities that were never designed for that number of people. Those become incubators for COVID. If you then have to release those people, as we were a year ago, after 20 days, you release them into the community, and there's a significant concern about the complete collapse of the public health system along the border. We're already seeing a lot of stress in El Paso, the Rio Grande Valley, and San Ysidro over in California. This would be a monumental mistake, and the Biden administration currently has said it tends to keep those in place at least for a while. On that same vein, I was one of four sheriffs in the United States to have an opportunity to interview his nominee for Secretary of Homeland Security, and that's a guy by the name of Alejandro Mayorkas. I was impressed by him. He's actually a pretty good choice. I think if he's confirmed, he will be a pretty common sense voice to Department of Homeland Security.
That's very good. We got 1 minute left. Anything else you want to get across?
Just to the people of Pima County, thank you for the honor of being able to serve you for 4 years as your sheriff. I'd have loved to have done it for another 4 years. We did amazing things in 4 years. I testified before Congress twice. We balanced our budget and gave back $16 million to the taxpayers of Pima County. We engaged in law enforcement reform that was very meaningful. We conducted the sheriff's office like a business, as it should be. I brought a sensible voice to border issues, and I'll continue to do that in leadership in southern Arizona. I'm very proud of our COVID response, and we obtained national accreditation for our detention facility under my watch. So thank you, Pima County, for the honor of serving you as your sheriff. It meant a lot to me and my family, and one of the highest honors I've had in my career life.
Well, Sheriff Napier, thank you so much for your time. Hopefully at some point we'll be able to say Governor Napier.
I don't know. I think I'm unelectable. I'm too reasonable.
Oh, well, that's where we're going to leave it for today. Thank you, Mark, for taking time away from your honey-do list. Kiss your wife. Tell her you love her.
And I will. I'm going to exchange the battery in her car right now. That's what she's got me doing.
Perfect. A great honey-do list it is. So until next Saturday when we have a new show reviewing 2020, the lost year, for Inside Track and Bruce Ash, this is Eb Wilkinson wishing you a very pleasant good afternoon and a very happy new year.
Customers come first at Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus.
What other kind of customers do you have?
So our biggest customers are actually like ranchers and people from outside of the Tucson area. They're buying a lot of square tubing. They're buying a lot of stuff for their ranch to close off fences.
We'll sell anything from 10 feet to 10,000 feet to somebody that comes in because we have new steel and surplus steel from steel mills. The reason we're able to get such good pricing on some of this stuff is, A, we sell scrap to the mill. So we have a relationship there, and then we can buy material, what they're making, bringing it back. And so we save on freight, and we have relationships for years with them. So I think that's really our niche market. We'll sell whatever you need.
Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. Call 209-1579. Stop by the yard, 701 East 36th Street. Open Monday through Saturday.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Wouldn't it be great if political leaders could create that country again? Learn how to do exactly that, one family at a time, with Imus Wilkinson Investment Management. Call me, Eb Wilkinson. IMUSWilkinson.com. 777-1911. 777-1911.